The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey guys, a big shout out to YouTube Music. It's a new app that combines everything you'd expect from a streaming service with the magic of YouTube. And it just brings everything to life. I love it. With YouTube Music Premium, you'll get ad-free music that plays with the screen off or while using other apps. Get music whenever you want it, even if you're offline. Download the new YouTube Music app today and start a free 30-day trial. Then, just pay $9.99 per month. Of course, there's terms and restrictions that do apply, but I think this is the future of streaming music. It's YouTube Music, the premium version. It is highly recommended. It's where we can hear all our favorite hard rock and heavy metal music, the stuff that we love here on Talking Metal. So give them a chance, YouTube Music, and go download that app today and start your free 30-day trial.
Hi, guys. It's Emily. How's everyone doing? On this episode of Talking Metal, our guests are Adam Wakeman from Ozzy Osbourne's band and the legendary guitarist KK Downing of Judas Priest fame. But before we get into the show, I just want to say thank you so much to all of our Patreon supporters: Anthony Mackey, Metal Dan, BJ Goklowski, Brody Goklowski, Fred Rutz, James Bennett, Jay Vaninsky, hey Jay, JB Allen, John Francois, blah, blah, I can't pronounce that last name. I'm so sorry if I slaughtered that. Jens Jacobson, John Boveri, Michael Street, Mike Jones, David Gray, Ralph Petrie, Rick Bunch, Ron Keel, hey Ron, what's up? Sean Morgan, Steve Hoker, hi Steve. Steven Saylor. Wow, this list gets longer and longer every time. I'm so excited about this. And we thank each and every one of you so much from the bottom of our hearts.
Hi, I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. On this episode, we're going to talk some rock, some metal, and
anything else we feel like.
We're also going to jam some tunes, have a drink, and share some honest opinions. Thanks for listening to the Talking Metal Podcast. Let's get things started. Here's an old classic that sounds just as good today as it did when we were kids.
Stop me now, I'm All right, a classic Judas Priest song here on Talking Metal. That song right there, Reckless. And Emily and I are in the middle of reading this great book that KK Downing has released with a guy you've met on
Mark
social media.
Mark Eglinton, yeah, right. And
he mailed
said
you the book.
He mailed me the book.
Thank you, Mark.
And then you stole it from me.
Yeah. We're both reading it at the same time, so there's two separate bookmarks in it right now.
Right,
yeah.
Right. It's so good so far. Such a good read. I recommend all of you read it. And I know there are a lot of headlines out there right now about it, because it gets a headline, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of blabbermouth headlines out there, but my advice to everyone is to read the book.
Absolutely. And we have the one and only KK Downing on the show with us today, along with Adam Wakeman, who is just the incredible keyboard player, has always so much great stuff going on. So stay tuned for both of those interviews coming up momentarily. We just heard Reckless by Judas Priest, which in the book, there's a cool story about that kind of deep cut that they wanted that song for the Top Gun soundtrack. And Judas Priest turned down the producers of the movie. And KK, in retrospect, thinks that that was a mistake, obviously, because Top Gun went on to be this just massive movie, and it could have had a Judas Priest song on the soundtrack. They wanted that song. They didn't get it. It ended up on Turbo. So that and so many other great stories in this book. Without further ado, let's get into my interview with KK Downing. Always an honor. Last time we had this guy on the podcast was about a decade ago. Craziness. But he is back. It's been far too long. So glad he's back with us here on the podcast. And a big thanks to Mark Eglinton for helping hook up the interview. Thanks, Mark. Here we go. My conversation with KK Downing, former Judas Priest guitar player. Hey, it's Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and what an honor to speak to one of the founders of the music we all love, KK Downing. Thank you so much for talking with us again on Talking Metal, KK.
Hi, Mark. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to yourself and all of the fans one more time.
Absolutely, and I'm really enjoying your new book, Heavy Duty, Days and Nights in Judas Priest. It is it's a wonderful read. I'm about 3/4 of the way through it, and I'm really just I can't put it down. Such good stuff.
Thank you very much, and like I say, I must thank Mark Eglinton, the co-writer there, that helped me so much to dig into my memory banks and dig deep and recall exactly how metal was actually made.
Absolutely. And where did you and Mark first meet?
Kind of over the phone, really, first, and for a while, really. I'd been approached quite a lot of times, you know, in recent years, and I thought, no, you know, not particularly interested to get into all of that. And I guess as time went on, I thought, well, you know what? There could be a few good reasons, really, to put some things in writing, really. A few things I could think about, and I'm very glad now that I did, and the book's out, and proving to be really quite popular, so it's really, really good.
Yeah, and I mean, there's great stuff in there. I really enjoyed hearing about your childhood and how, I guess I would say, difficult and at times awkward that was. I mean, that was something I never knew about you. I really enjoyed the stuff about Hendrix. Let's talk a little bit about Hendrix, because it sounds like that first time you saw Hendrix, it not only changed like the way you viewed music, it potentially changed the way you just viewed life in general. I mean, is that an overstatement, or do you agree with that?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was just one of those things. I think we all go through that, hopefully, at some point, you know, something happens to us when we're a certain age, very influential, and something happens, and it's kind of an unbelievable experience, really, and you can't quite believe what you're hearing or seeing, you know, and that was me. And I'm thinking, wow, does this exist on the planet? You know, it's something that, you know, I had no idea. Obviously, I'd heard the record before I went to the concert, but obviously to see Hendrix perform in the way that he did in those magical years, and it was a very short window, in all fairness, you know, before Jimmy had become somewhat affected by the industry and the business, that, you know, the whole thing. You know, it's like, you know, often, you know, things happen. And I think some of that happened with Priest, really, because when we were young and we were fighting in the trenches, trying to get there, didn't have any money, there was no particular success. You know, there was kind of the fun, genuine times, but we went out there and, you know, killed the shows just naturally as free spirits. But later on, things creep in, you know, and I think that's what happened with Jimmy, because obviously it's quite well documented now that he did have some problems with management and, you know, and other things that were affecting his performance later on, you know.
And you really stayed a fan of his right up until the end, and there's even this story in the book where you kind of, I guess, snuck back to where he was in a backstage area, and you got to meet him. I think it was only like three weeks before he passed on.
Yeah, that was at the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970. We were kind of, me and my buddies, we were kind of past masters at getting into gigs, you know, because we, you know, without paying, because we didn't have any money, and the Isle of Wight was no exception. But managed to get into the press pitch right up the front. But before that, managed to get to find out which they had, like, caravans that they were using for dressing rooms, and we could kind of hear these voices. And I said, "That's Jimmy's voice, and that's Noel," you know. And we knew that they were in that caravan, you know, so we kind of, those old English caravans, you could kind of lift the windows up, and there were some curtains, and so that's what we did, you know, and pull the curtains apart, and the guys would just sat there, like, around a little square table, you know, with a girl or two, and, you know, and I said, "Hey, Jimmy, you know, can we get your autograph?" And I think I tell the story, you know, we had a Coke bottle that he was drinking a Coke out of, and, and a drumstick off Mitch, and it was quite magical, you know. But after a while, you know, the window had to go down because those guys had a gig to do, right?
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. And so much great history about the early stages of the bands and the different lineups that came in and out of the band. And I wanted to touch upon a song, "Victim of Changes," which is still, for us Priest fans, still just one of our favorites. It's interesting, you go into detail about this song, that it really came from two separate songs: "Whiskey Woman," which had been an early pre-Halford Priest song, and then one of Halford's songs, I believe, right? "Red Light Lady." So you sort of combined, it was a combination of these two songs that made "Victim of Changes"?
I think so. I think pretty much a lot of the lyrics stayed the same. You know, obviously it's the opening line of the song, "Whiskey Woman, don't you know you're driving me insane?" I think it is something like that, you know. But, we were playing that, you know, in the very, very early days. And I think when Rob came into the band, we made a couple of changes. And when Glenn eventually came into the band, and I think we made another change, and it went on to the second record, "Sad Wings."
Absolutely. Such a great record. And another thing that you hit upon numerous times in the book is the image of Judas Priest, the leather image that really came about, I guess, in the, you know, mid to late 70s, was, you know, something that a lot of the documentaries and articles that we read about heavy metal music really always pinpoints this to Rob, and that this was his image. But you really are the one that kind of pushed this image upon the band and got them interested in having a united image and the leather look. Where did you first think up, like, the leather would go with what we're doing? Was there somebody you saw? Was there somebody that influenced that leather look that kind of made that pop into your mind?
No, I think what it was, when I was growing up as a young kid, my two sisters used to drive me mad listening to the radio with all the pop bands and stuff like that. And all of these bands, obviously, a la the Beatles and a lot of the Mersey Sound, you know, there's lots of bands, all wore the same clothes and had the same haircut, and that seemed to be like the thing to do, you know, as a pop band. So I think not just me, but like I think about every other band thought, that is not what we're going to do, because we are a blues band or a progressive blues band or, you know, later a rock band. And so it was kind of commonplace to have, you know, various different, you know, outfits, you know, obviously some denim in there, flared pants, you know, it was the 60s, you know, going on the late 60s, and obviously some colourful stuff, shirts and that, and so it was the thing to steer away from was the uniform, but something didn't quite fit because, you know, we seemed to be a bit eclectic with the way that we looked, you know, we had a great band named Judas Priest, we had a great kind of dark, kind of moody, a lot of moody material and stuff like that. And these colours, these bright kind of and satins and stuff didn't really cut it, you know. But so I was wearing stuff like over the knee leather boots and stuff like that, and various things. But then it suddenly dawned on me that, you know, we've got all of this wrong. What we really do need is a uniform to, you know, so that we will be more, we'll have a more powerful, for want of a better phrase, I think we'll be more, you know, a more forceful kind of unit if we have some kind of something that brings everything together. So, you know, so 76, 77, I started. And, of course, the obvious thing was black's got to be the colour for our music, surely. You know, it can't be pink or green or something like that, you know, or yellow or cream. It's got to be black, you know. I thought, well, if you wear all black, people might not be able to see, so get some shiny bits on there, and you're good to go. So this started to evolve in me as a person. Obviously, there's some photographs in the book. There's some videos on YouTube. And so I had a chat with Rob, see if he fancied coming to London, you know, to go to have some leather clothes made, and he was totally up for it, as he would be. And then for a while, myself and Rob were wearing some stuff like that. And then the rest before, next to no time, we were all kind of doing that. And by the time British Steel was born, you know, we had everything came together, you know, the band name. So a great album with songs, you know, we had the image, great album cover. You know, we didn't know how great he was at the time, the razor blade. We thought it was maybe a bit risky, but, because the story goes, originally that razor blade did cut into the fingers and there was blood, but we were talked into erasing that, you know, and changing it a little bit. So that's kind of what happened. So, but after that, kind of everything was consolidated. And I couldn't have been more happy. And of course, it came to be true when we were two with Kiss or Led Zeppelin, Alice Cooper, Foghat, whoever it was. You know, we really did seem to be a powerhouse. You know, when we hit that stage, you know, looked good, felt good, and that kind of more uniform look in a way made us feel pretty unified and strong.
I totally understand that. And another thing you touch upon in the book is this kind of strange period in hard rock and heavy metal, which was the late 70s, like 1978, 1979, that, you know, at that point, Sabbath was kind of on their last legs. Even Zeppelin was changing their sound and on their last legs, literally, too. You guys were one of the few bands kind of still out there in the mainstream flying the hard rock, heavy metal flag. But how aware were you of what was going on in the underground? You know, there was this movement that later became known as the new wave of British heavy metal. Were you guys kind of tuned into that and seeing that there was this group of young kids who were still flying the heavy metal flag?
Yeah, no, it was fairly unknown to us because we were pretty busy. We were in other countries recording albums and touring and stuff like that. You know, it was a pretty tough period in the 70s, as you say there, you know, because of all the punk and the new wave thing. A lot of people had to ride that storm out. Less and less rock bands were touring the UK. In 1 year, I think there was just us, UFO, and that was it, you know. Yeah. The rest of it was all this new wave and punk movement, so it was kind of, a lot of people were kind of keeping their heads down a bit for a while, I think. But obviously, we kept on going with other bands as well. You know, the Scorpions were out there somewhere. So I suppose these youngsters, I mean, still remembered seeing us before all of this happened in the early 70s. And of course, you know, they were kind of always there, probably honing their skills and that. And unfortunately, by the time British Steel came out, you know, and just in the late 70s, some of these bands started to emerge, like Venom, Saxon, I think, you know, Def Leppard. In fact, Def Leppard, they did their first album. I think they actually came to the recording studio. We were actually recording British Steel, and they'd appointed Tom Allen, our producer, to record their first record. Right. So they came down to the studio and asked if they could watch us record for a while, which they did one evening, you know. But they were very young. And so, yeah, it all started to grow. And I think on the back of bands like Priest, like, say, UFO, Scorpions, and et cetera, I think that, yeah, it's a blessing that those guys came along, you know. And you know, we were able to take pretty much all of those guys on tour with us, as supporting one way, obviously Maiden, Saxon, Def Leppard. So that was good. And obviously all of those guys went on to be obviously total bona fide headliners, arena bands in their own right.
And you mentioned Iron Maiden, and we've always heard that in the early 80s, there was some tension between Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. And you know, for the first time, I really think you go into more detail about that than I've read. And it's interesting because, you know, Maiden, when they came out, especially in their early days, they had the leather. They looked very much like Judas Priest. Paul Di'Anno, even with the belts and the, I mean, it was an exact Judas Priest outfit. But you mentioned that the tension really, it seemed to come more from their end. At one point you talk about them watching you guys and studying you guys at a sound check, and there was you know, almost, should I say, like a bad attitude from them towards you. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it was somewhat unsettling at the time, but I think it was about 1985, 1986, I actually met Paul Di'Anno. I mean, he came along and did apologize.
Right.
He basically said, sorry, KK, we were just a bit, you know, over-enthusiastic at the time. Well, fine, that's all you need, isn't it, really? You know, understood. it was difficult for us because it was a long, hard struggle for Priest. We just had to work hard, and we were very humble and very appreciative of anything that we could get, really, from the industry, you know. And when we first went to America to tour with big bands, you know, everyone said, don't expect anything, because, you know, if you get anything, it's a bonus, you know, whether it's light, sound, or, you know, stuff in the dressing room or whatever. And we accepted that, you know, we accepted that. And we thought, we'll have our day, we'll just go about our work. And of course, that too, when Maiden supported us, they kind of did, I think they would have to admit that they did play up and cause some upsets, really, wanting bigger stages, more stage room.
Right.
And often we didn't have enough ourselves, you know, as a headliner. But I don't know what it was all about, but I suppose, you know, it was just a little bit of early days delinquency. But
yeah,
like I say, a lot of water's gone under the bridge now, and obviously met quite a few of the guys since, you know, really get on great with Nico. He's known Nico a long time. He's a great guy. But I'm really glad now that I'm, that, as you say, initially I would look at photographs in magazines. I think, is that us?
Right.
looks like, you know, it looks like us.
Yeah.
But the main thing is the guys that went out there, did what they did, and they've become completely bona fide. And I'm immensely proud to say that they're a British export, and obviously it would be hard to imagine a metal world without Iron Maiden. And I sincerely wish them all of the best on their endeavors, you know, now and in the future.
And, you know, earlier this year I sat down and interviewed Scott Travis, and he told me during that interview that one of his favorite drummers of the Judas Priest legacy was Les Banks. And you talk a lot about Les in the book. It's great to read these stories. Again, guys, the book is Heavy Duty: Days and Nights in Judas Priest by K.K. Downing and Mark Eglinton. Great, great read. But in the book, you briefly mentioned that you got together rather recently with Les. And was this just, was this the first time you had seen him since back in the day, or had you been in contact through the year? Wow. Why did you reach out to him? Was it for the book, to research, just to hang?
A friend of mine was somewhere at a pub or club, and Les was there, and they were having a chat and a few beers, and they decided to give me a call, and which was good. And then Les came up to see me, and he said, "Hey, do you fancy, for the hell of it, re-recording Beyond the Realms?" And, you know, and so I'm kind of doing this thing, and people ask me to do things, and I just kind of do it. You know, I need to stop, really, and think about what I'm going to do seriously. But it's kind of fun, really. But it was great to see Les again, you know, because Les was a fantastic drummer. We know that, you know, because, you know, and he's a top drummer. You know, he's played with so many great people, obviously done a lot of sessions in the London area, and still plays great today. So, yeah, there's no doubt about it. Les brought a lot to Judas Priest.
Absolutely. And when you look back on that Turbo record, you know, I remember speaking to Glenn Tipton maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and there has been a portion of the fan base that, you know, they didn't like that you guys went in a little bit more commercial style with that record. But Glenn had told me that he really likes that record after all this time has passed, and still looks fondly on it. How do you look back on the Turbo album by Judas Priest?
Yeah, all I can say is the fact that, you know, guys, you know, everybody listening out there, life is can be a relatively long time, you know. We were doing what we do for decades, and so there was lots of changes in the economy, and, you know, in the recessions, happiness, you know, the industry, you know, lots of things happen depending where you are at the time. You can feel a certain way in your own personal life, you know, and all this has an effect, really, on what you do and how you do it. But these records, you know, they represent a very, very special period. You know, they all represent a period in our lives. And it's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like your mom giving birth to your brothers and sisters. You know,
right.
She probably remembers, you know, it's a special, you know, period. And it's hard to denounce any of your children. You know, they are products of what you produced at the time. You know, and you did the best you could. And it was what it was. Turbo came out in the mid-80s, and everybody's got to agree, it was great then. There was a massive infusion, you know, in the 80s of, like, great bands were coming to the surface, left, right, and center, great concerts. There was a feel-good factor, and everything was just, you know, just full steam ahead. You know, in particular with rock and metal, the way that, and I think there was a great interest in, you know, where it had come from, where it was, and where it was going. Everybody was excited to know what's going to happen next. You know, there's going to be another big festival, another supergroup, you know, appear, and it seemed to be that way, that superstars were being born almost every week.
Yeah. Yeah, and to jump ahead just a little bit to the 1990s and just a few more questions because I know we're almost out of time here. But how close did you pay attention to Rob's musical output in the 1990s when he wasn't in Judas Priest, you know, Fight, and then he did the Two project with John Five, his Halford, his at least the first Halford record he did before he was back in Priest. How closely were you and Ian and Glenn paying attention to his releases?
Not much, really, to be fair. Not much. You know, Rob actually left the band for 14 years.
Wow.
It was a long time, you know, obviously, but we got the incredible Ripper Owens in there, you know, and he helped us sustain and do what we did. Obviously, fans wouldn't perceive Ripper's voice as great as it is to be the voice of Judas Priest, so it's difficult to get a wide spectrum of acceptance, but it's undeniable how great he is. Not many vocalists in the world. I mean, you can count them on one hand, you know. It's just five. We're lucky, really. Yeah. I mean, I think with Rob, you know, Ripper, Ralph Shapers, and, you know, and you know, I'm probably missing some guys out who've got great voices. There's some good singers out there, but, you know, at the top of the tree there, you know, it's you know, they're very hard to find and hard to come by, you know. And so we're very lucky, really, to have had these great singers perform, you know, in Priest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in one point in the book, you mentioned how when you had Rob in the band, you guys were actually in the early days before the album, you know, the first album came out, you were actually afraid somebody might steal him out of the band, which is interesting to think about.
Yeah, that certainly could have happened because things were evolving so fast, really. You know, things were starting to take off, you know, in the 70s.
Right on.
You know, that could well have happened, really.
Well, thank goodness it didn't. And I know I got to let you go, KK, but real quick, do you ever plan to release any new music on your own or with another group? Is there plans to release music?
I think about it, you know, but I'm kind of certainly, there's a certain reluctance in me to want to kind of start over, you know, when I've kind of been party to Judas Priest ever since I was a teenager. You know, it's a hard pill to swallow, really, to think about
right.
It. But the winter's setting in now. Well, you know, we're in autumn, but this is England, so it's going to get pretty cold, and the clocks go back fairly soon, so it's going to be early. So, you know, I'm going to shut myself away this winter, I think, in the music room and see what comes out at the other end of spring, I guess.
All right. It's always great talking with you, KK. And again, the book is just fantastic. We encourage all the Talking Metal listeners to check it out. Heavy Duty, Days and Nights in Judas Priest. We will have it linked through our show notes on talkingmetal.com where you can buy it on Amazon. And it's a great read. So thank you for sharing your life with us in this book, KK.
And thank you, Mark, and to all the fans and all the listeners out there. And, you know, thanks a lot for all the support over the, I won't say years, but decades. And hope to see you again, you know, somewhere in the world soon.
You take care of yourself, KK. We are so thankful for the music you've given us through the years. And, it's just always an honor.
Thank you, Mark. And obviously keep up the good work that you do.
Well, thank you. You take care now.
Cheers, mate. Take care. Bye.
Judas Priest with Ripper on vocals, Tim Ripper Owens on vocals on that one. One on One from that 90s era, actually 2001.
We got Adam Wakeman coming up in just a second. We should go to Germany to see Ozzy.
We've been talking about this. So we talked about going for the final Black Sabbath show in, was it in Birmingham? I don't know where it was. Black Sabbath. And, right. and that never happened, of course. No. So then we thought, all right, let's go for some of the final dates, Ozzy dates. Well, not dates, but from the No More Tours tour. And we've never been to Deutschland.
Yeah.
Du bist ausgezeichnet. Aber ich habe ein großes Kopfschmerzen.
Sure. I don't know what you just said. But yeah, it's interesting because Ozzy's playing in Hamburg on one night. And then the very next night, Ghost is playing. So it could be a 2-for-1 trip over there. I mentioned it to my mom, by the way, to see if she could watch the kids. And so we're still discussing that. We need to look into a few things. But it would be great to see Adam Wakeman.
Adam, he's the best.
On stage with
what
Ozzy.
A nice guy.
One more time. And again, it's always a pleasure to talk with Adam, and he's got so much great stuff going on. We're going to get into a song which is a little different for us on Talking Metal, but I love this song. It's mellow, and the lyrics, they really brought the singing really brought a tear to my eye. This is Red Sox. Give it a chance, guys. I love it. I love it. Piano, vocal, not much else. Great stuff. And it's by Wilson and Wakeman. It's here on Talking Metal. Followed by my interview with Adam Wakeman, of course, the son of Rick Wakeman. And, we do mention Rick a little bit in the interview. And Rick played keyboards, or piano, I should say, Emily, on that beautiful song that you and I both love, Life on Mars by David Bowie.
Right.
And Adam mentions that song during the interview.
Talk about good genes.
Yeah.
And now I think his daughter is following in his footsteps, too, from what I understand on his Twitter.
Oh, nice.
So third generation, maybe, player.
Awesome. This is Red Sox by Wilson and Wakeman, followed by my interview with Adam Wakeman from the Ozzy Osbourne Band.
I do recall when I was only 5 years old, I had a pair of red socks that I valued. And I remember when we traveled as a family to the coast for Sunday at West Wittering. I watched my father take the football socks I cherished, tying them to a kite, they hovered up above me. But when they escaped to the waves out in the ocean, my brothers and my father, I was taunted. It may seem strange, but I was heavily affected and wanted to return back to West Wittering. Took the blindest bit of notice, still there I stood and stared into the distance. And if they ever thought to ask what I was doing, then I'd reply that there was something that was missing. And to this day I do believe they've been recovered, but wonder whereabouts along the coastline. Sometimes it's difficult to say goodbye. Sometimes it's difficult to say goodbye. One afternoon you had informed me you'd be over so we could spend a day to be remembered. But when you didn't come, I felt so much alone, and my mind went back to a Sunday in West Wittering. There as a man I stood and stared into the distance, fighting tears, it seemed that something here was missing. If I could phone you, then I'd tell you how I first learned at 5 years old that my heart, it could be broken. At 5 years old that my heart, it could be broken. At 5 years old.
Hey, it's Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and I'd like to welcome back on the podcast from the Ozzy Osbourne Band and many other bands and projects, Adam Wakeman. How are you, Adam?
I'm very well, thank you, Mark. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm great. And thank you, man, because my wife and I were down at the PNC Arts Center in New Jersey on a rather rainy night. The place was packed, and you guys, Ozzy, Blasco, Zach, and Tommy, and yourself, you just delivered such a great emotional night. For me, who's been an Ozzy fan literally, you know, since I was 11 years old, it really was an emotional evening. And thank you for that performance.
Oh, that's my pleasure. On behalf of everybody else, I'm sure they'd say the same thing. It's a great tour this so far. It's been Ozzy's on great form. The show's been really well received, and yeah, it's just kind of, you know, nobody seems disappointed, which is a good thing.
Yeah, no, it's great, and I love seeing you on stage. Last time with Sabbath, you were kind of off to the side there. It's so great to see you out there, right? You know, not front and center, but right on stage, right next to the other guys. So that's awesome.
I'm slowly moving further on. I'm slowly moving further into the middle. One day, Ozzy would be up on my riser. Yeah, it's funny. Sabbath's always been the same for all the shows I've ever done with them. I've always been off to the side. That's just the kind of nature of the gig. But yeah, Ozzy's always been kind of, you know, quite the keyboards have been a much sort of bigger part of the band than with Sabbath, for example. So right. It kind of makes, you know, it wouldn't make any sense to be, you know, off the stage.
Yeah, and you're doing some guitar playing too. You played guitar on, was it War Pigs? Was there another song
War
you played?
War Pigs, yeah, Fairies Wear Boots, right. And Paranoid. The way that kind of sort of worked was really when Gus G came into the band, where everything kind of changed a little bit, where we ended up kind of, we rehearsed about 50 or 60 songs over a month or so, and tried loads of other songs that he hadn't done for a long time. And on the Sabbath songs, it just made more sense to add a rhythm guitar when there weren't keyboard parts there originally. And then it just sort of stuck, really. Obviously, then went and did the two long Sabbath tours, the 13 and then the end. And Tony was keen for me to play more rhythm guitar rather than keyboards for the same right. reason. And you know, I'd prefer to do whatever makes it sound better. It's, you know, I'm not sort of precious about, you know, being a keyboard player and putting parts in that aren't there. It's more about making sure there's an authentic sound coming out the front for people that want to hear Sabbath songs played, you know, played properly. So it just kind of worked that I ended up playing more guitar, and then obviously when we're back with Ozzy, it's kind of it makes sense to do the same thing and just put the rhythm guitar down for, you know, works great in War Pigs because Zach goes off and does his long solo, and it's good to have a guitar underneath rather than keyboards, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It is such a fun night, and everyone needs to get out and see this final Ozzy tour. I'm actually, my wife and I were just talking, we may come over to Germany to see you guys play over there.
We're fantastic.
we're looking at it. It's Ozzy one night, and then Ghost plays the next night, so it'd be a win-win for us. So we're considering that
great.
In February.
Excellent. Yeah, I've just started seeing all the dates and stuff coming up where, we've got sort of, you know, the UK tour and the European stuff, quite a few German dates, and now Australia and New Zealand I see. I mean, I find out, as bizarre as it seems, some people don't believe me, but I tend to find out more on Twitter than I do from anybody else, because, you know, the dates and things move around so much and they get organized, and, you know, I basically get the kind of heads up that we're going to be busy, and then that's right. all I need to know, really. And then I'll add the dates to my diary when I see them on Twitter.
Right on. Coming into the interview, we heard a song that's a little different than what we usually play on the Talking Metal podcast here, but I think it's just such a beautiful song. It's Red Sox, and it's off the Wilson Wakeman album that came out earlier this year, The Sun Will Dance in Its Twilight Hour. I love that song, man. The lyrics, I don't know. I'd like, every time I listen to it, I'm like seeing and hearing different things, heavy stuff. I really am enjoying the record, and I got to say, that's probably my favorite song off the record. Any stories behind composing that beautiful short song?
I mean, Damien Wilson, that's the second album that Damien and I have written together. He's responsible for 90% of the lyrics and melody stuff on that. There's one song that I wrote and sang on, which is Battlefield.
Right.
And all the rest Damien wrote. Now, Damien is a I think is a fantastic storyteller, lyricist. There's a lot of thought goes into what he writes. And right up until the moment he's recording, he's changing bits and pieces. He's very kind of very conscious about making sure the story's right. But they mainly tend to deal with personal experience. And that song is literally as it sounds. It's like, you know, his dad and his brother thought it'd be funny and tied his pair of football socks to a kite, and they got swept off, you know,
right,
over the sea. And it kind of did affect him, you know. Obviously, as a child, it was like something that he valued above anything else, and then disappeared. And then, you know, it then draws round to the passing of his father, and the kind of that effect, that feeling of loss that he felt back there by the sea at that time. So it's kind of comedy in one sense, but also kind of deals with that kind of the tragedy and the feeling of loss that everybody feels at some point, whether it's a 5-year-old losing his toy or socks or whatever, or, you know, or losing a parent or something like that.
Right, right.
Later in life.
Absolutely. And it's a great record. Again, The Sun Will Dance and It's Twilight Hour by Wilson and Wakeman. And you guys are doing some dates, like pretty much a full UK tour coming up in January, right?
Yeah, we're doing, I think it's 15 or 16 shows in January, just before we start back up with Aussie again. I mean, it's kind of, it wasn't fully intentional to be quite so long, but we did a similar thing a year or so ago, year and a half ago, and a lot of the venues wanted us to come back, so it kind of worked out that it fitted in between when Aussie finishes. I mean, when Aussie finishes, I go on another short tour with the band Travis in the UK.
Okay.
So that leads me up to Christmas, and then it's straight into the Wilson Wakeman tour in January. I think I'm January the 5th, and I think finish that and go straight to Dublin to start the Aussie run. So it's going to be a pretty busy time.
Right on. And for that tour, the UK tour for Wilson Wakeman, what can fans expect in the set list? I'm guessing we're going to get some Headspace stuff, but also, you know, Wilson Wakeman stuff. Is there other, I mean, you have such a diverse musical history. What else would we expect to hear at those shows?
Well, we try and kind of mix it up as much as we can. I mean, we tended to, on the last tour, for example, we pulled a song in that my dad played a part of. We try and pull a connection with a song rather than just pick a song that we like to play. So, yeah, we did Life on Mars, which obviously was David Bowie's song that my dad played piano on the original. So we try and do an acoustic version of that. It's a pretty fully acoustic show. So there's always a real piano and a couple of acoustic guitars between us. And then we both kind of, you know, share the singing. But Damien takes the main bulk of that. So song-wise, we were actually talking about that the other day, just to see what we can throw in there. But, I mean, something that he wasn't planning on doing that was requested and it ended up sticking was Bring Him Home from Les Miserables, the musical, because Damien was the lead in Les Mis in London for a number of years. So even though musical theatre is not necessarily what you would associate with the kind of metal singer that is Damien Wilson, that is a kind of, it's a real showpiece, and you know, there's tears in the house when he sings that. It's pretty emotional.
Wow.
So
cool.
I don't know whether we'll put that one back in. It kind of depends really on how we start. We'll have a rough set list, and I'm pretty sure after three shows it will be completely different.
Very cool. And you guys, you know, you have such a great musical vibe, but you also have such a great conversational vibe, which I'm experiencing now on the podcast that you guys have started. And can you talk a little bit about how this all came about? I mean, it sounds like two friends just sitting down chatting, but it's you know, for me, it's very interesting. I love hearing about the you know, FNS syndrome and hugging the babysitter and stuff like that, which we can go into. But
it's, I mean, the thing with the two of us is we've known each other such a long time, but we're not in each other's pockets. It's not like we're touring kind of, you know, 10 months of the year. So when we see each other, it is like catching up, you know, two guys going on holiday, and that's kind of what it's like. We drive everywhere to the shows as well. I think on the last tour we covered about 7,000 miles, and I drove it all, and we talked the entire time, and then we get there and we do the show, and then we talk in between the songs and we tell stories and chat about whatever's, you know, whatever's current, whatever's going on, and what we think about it. And that always leads on to a story from one of us about a person experience, because we've both been on the road for such a long time. I think it's like 20, well, I'm 44 now, so it's 26 years I've been sort of doing this. It's kind of, there's always a connection. You know, if we talk about bus drivers, there's at least three or four, you know, hilarious bus driver stories, or, you know, plane scenarios or hotel disasters, or, you know, there's always something that we can kind of talk about. So it's, you know, we can be very honest. And with the podcast as well, when we sat down, I said, there's, you know, is there anything you're uncomfortable talking about? And he said, no. And I said, well, that's fine with me. We'll see where it goes. And that was kind of how they started.
Yeah. It's a fun listen. And when you started talking about the FNS syndrome, I started thinking about myself, because by the way, that's forward neck syndrome. Do you want to explain what that actually is?
Yeah. It's when you're at a festival and you're talking to them, and they are constantly looking over your shoulder to see if there's somebody more important to talk to. And it happens at every festival. It happens at any backstage area. And it's not well tolerated in the Wilson Wakeman camp, that's for sure.
Yeah, and thanks for pointing it out, because I feel like I do that. You know, I go backstage and I'm talking to somebody, and then I'm like, oh my God, there goes Ozzy. You know, and my attention drifts from the guy I should be talking to the more famous person. So
okay, so no, yeah. I'll excuse you on that one, Mark, because that's you're looking then at the boss, and that's kind of fine. It's right. When you're looking over somebody's shoulder in the hope to see somebody more important to talk to.
Right on.
So, and I'll give you a pass on that one.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Wanted to just talk about all the different people you've worked with. Well, not all of them, but touch upon some of them. Slash, what did you do with Slash? Did you tour or record with him? What was your working relationship with Slash?
My very first show was when he did the Slash and Friends stuff. It was quite a few years ago now, and he did a show in Norway, and needed somebody to go and play keys. So that was the first show I did, and then he came and worked with us and did the Aussie and Friends shows. So we did about 10 or 12 Aussie and Friends shows through the summer. I can't remember what year that was now. Probably just before the Sabbath stuff started in 2013, so 2011, something like that. And he's great. I mean, as a kid growing up, I had kind of sort of three or four favorite guitar players, which would have been obviously Tony Iommi, Slash, Eddie Van Halen, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. They were the four my go-to guitar players that I would, you know, listen to and sort of study. And and to work with him was fantastic. And he was, you know, he was. Oh, in fact, actually, do you know, he came and did a show with us long before that as well. He came and guested on guitar with Ozzy in Wales. We did a show for the Royal Variety Performance, which is the most unusual thing. You would expect Ozzy to be on, but it was like it's a Royal Variety kind of show where the Queen and stuff are there and in a theatre, and this one was in Wales, and Slash came over to guest on that, and we were there all week, so I got to spend a week with him, and it was great. It was just like spending a week with your idol and not being disappointed. It was great.
Very cool. I tell you what, we're going to get into some music right now, and then we're going to come back and talk some more with Adam Wakeman. This is Follow Me Under by Snake Charmer here on Talking Metal.
You're
little snake charmer here on Talking Metal, who put out a great second record last year. Adam, I see they're going to be doing some dates, but I'm assuming you're not going to be playing live with them this time around because you're just so busy with all this other stuff.
Well, yeah, unless they can somehow come up with some time-traveling machine, I don't see how I can come forward to get back to England to do. I love doing those shows with Snake Charmer because I play real Hammond, and it's just it's a real just rocking kind of, you know, 70s rock style band. It's great fun. But
about the connection with Whitesnake? Obviously, the Snake Charmer name has a connection with Whitesnake. Can you just talk a little bit about the band and what it's all about?
Sure. Yeah. When it first started, I wasn't involved, and they were called Monsters of British Rock or something. It was Neil Murray, Mickey Moody, Harry James from Thunder, and Laurie Wisefield from Wishbone Ash. And it wasn't really intended to be a kind of Whitesnake type covers band, but they played a few Whitesnake songs, and it was mainly, you know, then playing songs from the other guys' bands as well. So it was kind of like a covers band, but with members of those bands in it. And then shortly before I joined, they kind of changed the whole thing and started thinking of it as more of a new band rather than playing a lot of old songs. And then when I joined, we wrote the album, and it was kind of, you know, it was well received on Frontiers Records, and we did quite a few shows and stuff. And then Mickey left, and we got a great new guitar player, Simon McBride, who is fantastic. I don't know if you've heard of Simon.
No, I don't know Simon.
He plays with Don Airey as well, actually.
Oh, okay.
He's a young Irish guy, superb guitar player. Like a kind of... an even better Joe Bonamassa, if I can put him in that kind of category. So it started to become less Whitesnake and more kind of just a bit more of its own entity, really. But with the second record as well, and then with Mickey not being there either, it's got even less of a kind of Whitesnake connection. But I think definitely a, you know, it's got that vibe of the 70s Whitesnake. That's definitely the kind of association, but unfortunately the problem that arises constantly, same with Headspace, is that everybody's got so many other things going on, it's finding the time to actually commit to doing runs of shows.
Right on. And you mentioned Headspace. I want to get into a little music by Headspace right now. This is Fall of America by Headspace. We'll be right back. Headspace here on Talking Metal. We are talking with Adam Wakeman. I mean, that song right there, depending, I guess, on your political views, almost has more relevance today than anything, the fall of America.
It's the funniest thing. Damien and his lyrics, he's often way ahead of the curve. So one of the first Headspace songs we wrote was a song called Bodysuit, which was on an EP we did. It's only a really small number release EP. And it was kind of predicting the financial meltdown, and that was written in 2000 and five or something. Wow. And that's quite poignant. And the same with Fall of America, that was 2011, I think, or 12, 2012.
Yeah. I had 2012. Yeah,
that's bizarrely, you know, slightly predictive, depending on which way you stand. But one of the things with Damien and his lyrics is that he's not judgmental with his songwriting. He is kind of he's kind of conveying a multitude of opinions, but not his own, if you like. It's like observations on society. That's definitely something that's evident in both Headspace albums. That song does seem to be, you know, even more poignant these days. In fact, we've had a couple of inquiries about use of that on some films.
Really? Wow.
Recently, which, so you might end up hearing that on a film or two coming up.
Very cool. Do you envision that you and Damien will get back to making loud, heavy music like that again at some point? I mean, again, the new record is so beautiful, but it's definitely a softer feel. Do you envision a time where Headspace will return in all its loud volume?
Definitely. I spoke to Pete Rinaldi from Headspace, the guitar player, yesterday about trying to get some days together so we can book some time in the studio and get writing.
Cool.
And unfortunately, he had his guitar stolen, his 8-string guitar, which was what he wrote and used on the last Headspace album. So we're currently all on Twitter trying to find that before it gets sold somewhere around the world.
Right.
He's got to wait 2 months for another one to be made. But
wow.
Yes, we are booking dates in to start writing for the next Headspace album. So hopefully, how long's a piece of string, but hopefully it won't be too long.
Right. Cool. Well, we look forward to that. And 15 years now with Ozzy, is that right?
I know, it's kind of bizarre, isn't it? It goes so quickly. I look back. I keep a record of all the dates I've done with every band on my website, just mainly so I can go back and see where I was at a certain time, or if we played in the city before. It's quite a good reference if you go into a town and you think, I'm sure I played it before, and having a reference of where you've been is quite useful. Just looking back, going all the way back to sort of 2004 and when we first did a couple of TV things, and time has flown.
Wow. Wow, and you got Zach back in the band now, and I imagine that's changed the vibe quite a bit, and
yeah, whenever any kind of personnel changes, you know, it's kind of the same when Mike Borden left and Tommy came in. It's kind of, there's always going to be a change, there's always going to be a slightly different dynamic, but that's to be expected, and also kind of encouraged, really. I think everybody knows that, you know, Ozzy's definitely not one of those kind of revolving door type gigs. You know, he values the people in the band, and at the same time, you know, we're all fully aware that, you know, he can have whoever he likes in the band. You know, he could call upon anybody. It's Ozzy Osbourne. So we're all, you know, grateful to be here, and I think that's the best piece of advice to any musician that I give when I talk to young musicians, is that, you know, you're not guaranteed a living in any band or any environment, just like any job. You know, it's like you're hire and fireable. It's like you can be replaced and never get complacent about your position. And, you know, I've had a fantastic run here with Ozzy, and I'll be here. You know, I prioritize Ozzy over everything. So
right.
I'm happy to be here and keep playing as long as he wants me. But, you know, at the same same time. If you know, if he suddenly said, "I want your dad to come and play instead of you," right. You know, I'd be graciously passing on that mantle. But it's been great, and you know, we've got a lot more shows ahead of us.
Absolutely. And you know, you mentioned your dad, who of course has a history with Ozzy and Sabbath, and played on Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, the song, I think, Zabra Kadabra, right? He was playing some keys on that. Yeah. And does I know in Ozzy's book, he shares some colorful stories about, or at least one colorful story about your dad. Does Ozzy ever kind of pull you aside and share stories about your dad with you from the 70s?
Yeah. Quite regularly. And my dad does the same thing. It's like a different... It's almost like hearing about different people back then, because it was such a long time ago. My dad was a very heavy drinker, and it was a time where, you know, in studios there'd be bands and they'd all kind of go and disappear for 24 hours in the bar, and you know, that's how dad ended up on that track, really. Right. You know, they're in the bar and Ozzy and Tony, you know, collared him in to come and play on something. But you know, to hear the stories and stuff is kind of like hearing about a different person, because you know, my dad hasn't drunk for 35 odd years or maybe longer. And, you know, and he can't remember a lot of stuff. You know, he tells me some of the stories. My dad tells me stories when he was on tour, and he kind of can't remember, you know, whole legs of tours, which right. seems so out of character nowadays. But, you know, back then it was kind of part and parcel of being in a rock band. But, Ozzy's always got on well with my dad, and my dad's always, you know, got on well with him. It's kind of a nice, you know, sort of a very, it's quite a comforting feeling when you kind of, you're with a band and there's a, you know, they've got a history with your parents. It's like, I don't know, it's like chatting to somebody that knew your parents 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's awesome. Of course, I got to ask, I know I might not get an answer, but I got to ask, are there any plans for new Ozzy music?
Well, not that I've heard. I mean, I don't, as I say, I find out tour dates online, right. So I'd be the last to know. I'd be the last to know if there was any new stuff coming out. I mean, who knows? Anything is possible, you know, in this business. So, who knows?
Do you guys ever like jam on new riffs or anything on soundcheck and stuff?
Yeah, not so much at soundcheck, because the soundcheck's mainly taken up doing the kind of just the show stuff, making sure everything's up and running for the show. It's not really, everything's run on quite a tight schedule. So there's not really a lot of time. I mean, I try and find a piano in a hotel when I'm here and hopefully if there's nothing going on in one of the rooms at the hotel, I can kind of sneak in for a few hours and do some writing and stuff. So I kind of try and keep busy in that respect. But as a band, no, we don't sort of, you know, get to a rehearsal room and jam stuff as such, no. But right. The sound check kind of leads into a little bit of an extended version of something normally.
Yeah, very cool. Adam, it's always a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for spending some time with us here on Talking Metal.
It's been great talking to you, Mark. I mean, you know, if anyone's in the UK, come and see us with Wilson Wakeman, and then obviously Ozzy on tour through February and March into Australia and stuff. Just, you know, come along, and if you see me in a bar, and come and say hello, and I'll talk the ears off you for about 2 hours, which is what I tend to do.
We were following you on Twitter the other night when you were in the city in New York City. I think you were out drinking some tequila or something, and it was definitely a colorful Twitter exchange that got going on.
Yeah, I decided after that I should really turn Twitter off once I've had two drinks. Now, I've got friends who say, you know, don't buy me more than five, not me personally, but they would say don't buy them more than five drinks. After five drinks, it goes south. And I think that's kind of what happens with Twitter. It's like after too many drinks, and there were just kind of bottomless margaritas at this Mexican or that I was having, and I'd gone out on my own, so I was just kind of, you know, right. A bit bored. So yeah. opened up Twitter and opened up to many new friends.
Great stuff. All right, Adam, thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks, Mark. We'll be right back.
Osborne with I Want It More. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. Support us on Patreon and buy a t-shirt. Just send me $20 on PayPal. Buy a t-shirt. I got all the sizes in stock. I'll mail them right out to you. They're $20 each. This is Pain and Pleasure, some classic Judas Priest from 1982 to take us out here on Talking Metal. Thanks, Emily.
It was a good time, as always.